The threat is real and it is continuing. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An extraordinary scene at the White House today. The nation's top security and intelligence officials speaking in unison to denounce ongoing Russian meddling in U.S. elections.
Our focus here today is simply to tell the American people we acknowledge the threat. It is real. It is continuing. And we're doing everything we can to have a legitimate election that the American people can have trust in.
The question is, does President Trump agree or not?
I hope this means the president himself has finally, you know, is trusting American intelligence agencies. And I'd love to see him. I would applaud it if he would get up and say the same things we just heard in the White House.
That story and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is Thursday. Thanks for being here. It could have been described as an intervention if only we really knew what President Trump is thinking. But this afternoon, the White House National Security Team came out in full force to denounce meddling in the U.S. elections, contradicting what, at various times, their boss has asserted. Four leaders of the U.S. intelligence community described ongoing threats from foreign actors, including Russia, to interfere in this November's vote. Here's Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence.
We continue to see a pervasive messaging campaign by Russia to try to weaken and divide the United States.
David Rode is the executive editor of the New Yorker's website. He says this is something new for Trump officials.
What's new is the setting. This has never been said from the White House, that there is ongoing meddling by the Russian government in the midterm elections. They're much more open that this happened in 2016, and they're really sounding alarm that this is a very large, very sophisticated thing. And much of this is in contradiction to what President Trump has been saying for months. Dan Coats has been consistent that the Russians are meddling. Kirstjen Nielsen last week at the Aspen Security Forum, she talked vaguely about Russian actors, like she would not criticize the Russian government, whereas Coats was dead certain this is the Russian government. So to have them all sort of adopting the Coats line in the White House is unprecedented. And again, this is all because the president himself has sort of been all over the place on this issue, primarily saying this wasn't true, saying we don't know if it was Russia. It could have been, you know, as he said famously in the debates, a 400-pound man lying in a bed somewhere.
Right. How specific were the details when they spoke? They allege Russia is trying to weaken and divide the U.S. Did they explain how they're doing that?
To me, they are simply repeating the language of the unanimous intelligence assessment that came out, you know, right after the election. And, you know, they're just embracing the language that intelligence officials have said over and over and over again and been attacked for saying by this same White House. So it's extraordinary to have finally the White House adopting this line that they have been undermining and trying to discredit since the 2016 election.
They also said they're prepared to run counter operations to the Russian interference. Any details on that and what that would look like?
It's not clear to me what that would be. Earlier this week, Facebook talked about that they see new campaigns going online to sort of divide people and confuse them, and that the campaigns now this year are even more sophisticated than the ones in 2016, that whoever it is that's doing this online is even better at sort of imitating political actors in the United States and then, you know, sowing the division. They're posing as conservatives, they're posing as liberals, and they are just trying to divide us.
Yeah, so let's get back to that other headline that you were talking about earlier, which is really quite the compelling one here, because we've got Coates and Nielsen and Bolton all saying now that Russia is meddling, the FBI, CIA, NSA all said it happened in 2016. And as you said, Trump has said, yeah, no, maybe they did. Maybe, as you said, some 400-pound guy on his bed. What does this moment represent for the Trump White House?
You know, I think I want to applaud the White House for taking this step. I think the American public needs to hear a clear message about sort of basic fact. But the president of the United States needs to say this, and he needs to say it consistently. His voice matters the most. His voice is the loudest and the most authoritative. And his personal back and forth is what has confused, I think, so many Americans. And that back and forth helps the Russian goal of division and confusion. So I want to hear this from President Trump himself.
So you see this more than just mixed messages coming out of the White House. You see this as the clearest example yet of Trump officials being out of sync with the president.
Well, maybe they're in sync with the president, and I think this is a positive step. I hope this means the president himself, you know, is finally trusting American intelligence agencies. And I'd love to see him. I would applaud it if he would get up and say the same things we just heard in the White House.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people would love to hear more about Russia from Donald Trump, who actually sat down with President Putin in Helsinki. And when Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats was asked what he understood about what happened at that Helsinki meeting, he said he was not in a position to understand fully. That's the head of national intelligence. What does that tell us about who knows what in the White House really about Russian meddling?
It was astonishing. He said that again at this Aspen Security Forum that I was at last week. And people in the audience were just stunned. I mean, experts and journalists and others. There's never been a situation where a president of the United States sort of meets alone with the president of Russia and the top U.S. intelligence official, you know, is not briefed on what was actually said in that meeting. So again, this is a big step forward. It's the Dan Coats narrative that he has said consistently being embraced now by the White House instead of being shunned. But, you know, more disclosure. I mean, the president says he has nothing to hide, you know, yet he keeps bouncing around, changing his positions on Russia. So a clear statement by the president along the lines of what we heard from all these officials, I think, would actually help him politically.
And David, with the midterms coming up in under 100 days, did these White House officials say what they're going to do specifically to prevent any kind of meddling in those elections, or have been doing to prevent that?
There was talk of what they're doing, but I just think this is the, you know, the vexing problem with technology today. It's very hard to identify these actors. It's very hard to stop it. And the only solution, Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, said this also at this forum last week, is savvy Americans who are savvy about consuming information and are skeptical about what is popping up in their Facebook feed. It's only a sort of an informed, savvy citizenry that can brush off these efforts to divide us. That's the core thing is how individual Americans, and sort of believing a clear and I think consistent message from the government about this. And together, those efforts, a clear message from the government and engagement by average people is the best way to counter it.
David Rode, the executive editor of NewYorker.com, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meantime, over at the U.S. Treasury Department, they've slapped harsh sanctions on Turkey, targeting its interior and justice ministers. The sanctions are in response to the continued detention in Turkey of a U.S. evangelical pastor, Andrew Brunson. He's a North Carolina native who got charged by Turkey with espionage in 2016. Reporter Fariba Nawa has been following Brunson's case from Istanbul. Remind us, Fariba, first of all, who Andrew Brunson is and why his case has escalated tensions between the U.S. and Turkey.
Andrew Brunson is an evangelist here. He's been living in Turkey for the last 25 years. He is active in the Kurdish community, doing missionary work and humanitarian work. And he's an important ally of the Trump administration.
I mean, espionage is often a charge leveled at people by authorities in various countries, not just Turkey, authorities who want those people in jail. Do we have any sense of what Brunson actually did?
Brunson seems to have been doing missionary work, which is what evangelicals do. In Turkey, there's freedom of religion under the Turkish constitution. So legally, Brunson could freely preach and convert people. And that's become a controversial thing in Turkey, as, you know, it's a conservative government and a religious government. They don't like Turks being converted to Christianity, or Kurds for that matter. And Brunson was very active inside refugee communities in the Syrian camps, as well as working with some members, they say, that's part of the accusation of the PKK, and converting them to Christianity so that they could get asylum to the West.
Fariba, you've got an interesting perspective here because you've been working on some stories about religion in Turkey, Christianity in Turkey. How does the Brunson case fit into what you've been seeing?
Well, I've been visiting smaller churches in the hinterlands of Turkey and Anatolia and seeing something quite interesting. New churches are popping up full of refugees. Refugees are converting to Christianity as a way to seek asylum. And even though it's not really working right now, very few refugees are making it to the U.S. Under the Trump administration. But when Trump first got elected, he said, we will accept Christian refugees. And that sort of prompted this increase in the number of conversions.
So you recently got some documents from Brunson's lawyer. Have you learned anything new from them?
See, there was an indictment that was released to journalists by Brunson's defense lawyer. One of the things in the indictment is that Brunson was meeting with military officials at Incirlik Air Base, where the U.S. and Turkey worked together to fight in Syria. There's one other thing that struck me from the indictment, and it's a message that Brunson wrote to an American soldier about the coup right after the coup, that it had failed, but eventually that they would win. And that message has been passed around a lot on Turkish Twitter, and many Turks here think that he was an American spy.
Is Brunson's lawyer contradicting the indictment?
Yes, Brunson's lawyer is saying that much of the evidence is based on these two secret witnesses and that it's basically bogus. He's saying that it's conspiracy theories. Brunson's done nothing but love Turkey and love Turks and try to be there for them. And he was just doing God's work.
So how long has Andrew Brunson been in detention, and what will these sanctions actually do?
He's been in detention since October 2016, and these sanctions are more symbolic. First of all, it's the first time the American has imposed sanctions on a NATO ally. And the other thing, these ministers, the Interior Minister and the Justice Minister, the U.S. is saying that they were the most actively involved in Brunson's detention. And they're not allowed to do business with American citizens, and their properties and assets may be seized in the U.S.
How has Turkey responded to these sanctions?
Well, Turkish officials, including Erdogan's son-in-law, who's a very influential member of his circle, his inner circle, they have come out and said the U.S. cannot bully Turkey. We will come back. We will respond. But a State Department official told me that the talks are continuing, and they're hoping to come up with a solution fairly soon. But Turkey did say, one of the ministers that was a victim of these sanctions said that Turkey might impose similar sanctions to U.S. officials.
It seemed like Turkey and the U.S. were inching towards a deal that fell apart, though. I mean, like, are both countries willing to go to the mat for what they believe regarding Andrew Brunson?
It's interesting because I think that Andrew Brunson himself is symbolic of a larger issue here. Tensions have been escalating for the last 2 years. The U.S. and Turkey have had several issues to work out. One of them is alliance with the Kurds, which, the YPG in Syria is aligned with the PKK, Turkey says, and doesn't want the U.S. to support them. Meanwhile, the U.S. says that Kurds are our best allies in Syria. That's one of the issues. The other one is this exchange of hostages, as many analysts are saying, that Erdogan has publicly said, I'm paraphrasing here, we will give you your preacher if you give us Fethullah Gulen. But the U.S. hasn't complied with that because officials say that there's not enough evidence against Gulen for them to do that.
Reporter Fariba Nawa in Istanbul, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
A quick look now at a story coming up later in the show. It's about the crates containing human remains that North Korea handed over to the U.S. this week, remains that are believed to belong to U.S. service members who went missing during the Korean War.
We have no idea whether those 55 crates are 55 service members. In fact, if the past is any indication, they're probably not.
That's because in the past, North Korea has handed over boxes containing the remains of multiple people. But as we'll hear in a few minutes, the U.S. military has a technology to solve this mystery.
I think that majority of these can and will be identified. It is time-consuming, it is difficult, but they can do it.
That story coming up in just a few minutes right here on the show. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A plane crashed after takeoff Tuesday in Durango, Mexico. It burst into flames. Dorelia Rivera and her daughter were on board with other members of their church.
The only thing I really was able to grab was Kayla, my daughter, and her medicine. And we ran out as fast as we could and left everything else behind.
Heavy rain had begun to fall just as the plane taxied down the runway. Just after takeoff, it plunged and crashed nose first. But everyone, all 103 passengers on board, survived. Rivera, a Chicago resident, says it had started out as a normal flight.
I travel all the time. It's very normal. Went check-in, went to the gate, got our boarding passes, went through security. We were sitting with our family just talking and then got on the flight, normal. I was in row 5, which is right behind first class in the bulkhead, and then it was raining and dark and really, really a terrible storm, and we started to move, and I said to Kayla, my daughter, I'm like, you know what? It's okay. We're going to miss our connection because there's no way that we're going to take off in this at this time. There's just no way we're going to take off. So it's okay, Kayla, I told her. We'll miss our connection in Mexico City, but we'll take a later flight. And then right after I told her that, I was like, wow, we're still going. I can't believe we're even taking off. And so within a minute of me saying that to her, everything just started shaking, bouncing. We bounced up and down. My head was hitting the top where the luggage compartment is. Her head was hitting the top. So I grabbed her and hugged her, and I put my arm over her head and so she wouldn't hit the top of the airplane. And then as we felt like we skidded, and as soon as we stopped, I kept looking over to see where the flight attendant was, if the door was going to be open. And then when the flight attendant, I saw her walking towards the door, we bounced once again, and I hit the side of my rib cage on the armrest, and I felt something, you know, pressure on there. But either way, I just grabbed my daughter, I grabbed her medicine, and we were only row 5, but we were going to the front of the plane, and people kept on pulling us back, you know, trying to get over us. So after a couple of times of people pulling us back to get out, I grabbed her, and she's like, Mom, you're going to break my arm. I'm like, you are not staying on this plane. I don't care. You are coming with me. And I just did not let go of her arm until we ran out of the plane. And I honestly don't remember if there was stairs or mud, but right after we left the plane, I just remember running out, and I'm like, did we jump? Was there stairs? Were there mud? We landed kind of in a mud bank, and I ran out, got into the mud bank, and our pastor was outside. I said, Father Ezequiel, please come, please. He's like, no, no, no. He's like, just take everybody with you. Just run that way. Just take everybody with you. And I grabbed as many people as we could, and we just ran to some road. We were kind of like in a park forest with a bunch of thorn bushes, but we just ran through everything. And then it started hailing, so we were getting pounded with hail, but at the same time, we were all like, okay, this is just hail. It's actually helping the plane kind of damper the flames.
Yeah, because the plane at this point, it's in flames, right?
Yes.
What can you tell us about how everybody else from the flight is doing right now?
You know, I'm just grateful. From what I understand, nobody passed away. I know from our group, there's several people who are still injured. My pastor is actually still in the hospital in Durango, Mexico. He had surgery yesterday on his arm. So I know people are injured, but they came back. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're here.
I gather this was a church trip for you and some of the others on the plane. Why were you going to Durango?
Actually, it was not specifically a church trip. Every year, hundreds, if not 1,000 people go the last couple weeks of July, first week of August, to a little town in Durango, in the state of Durango. It's called La Purísima de Pehuanes, Durango. And we always have events during that week. And for example, the week that we were there, it was Father Ezequiel, our pastor's 50th birthday. My daughter's quinceañera was on July 26th. Our whole town, literally, those last 2 weeks, first week of August, is always full of people that come from here to Durango, and then take a bus or drive 3 hours to this little town really in the middle of the mountains with no internet, no phone, just great-great-grandparents are there. Great-great, you know, we can trace back to like the 1500s in this little town from our family. So that's why we go.
Aside from the return flight, how was the quinceañera?
Beautiful. We had a great time. My daughter actually has a really rare disease called NOMID. She's one of 67 in the world.
Wow.
And, you know, they told us she wouldn't make it to see 10 years old. So we celebrated, you know, in family, but beautifully. We had a mass. We had a taquiza. We had fireworks. We had music. We had a beautiful setup. She had her damas. It was one of the most beautiful days of my life with her, just because the mass was actually a massive Thanksgiving in her life.
It makes surviving this flight all that more remarkable.
I didn't want to see too many videos and pictures before coming home. But once I saw the video, the pictures, I said, absolutely, there's no way anybody I don't know how anybody, I don't know how one person survived. I really don't. I don't know how one person survived. I don't. I really don't. We were right in the first row, and the flames were in row 7. We were in row 5. Mm. And I was like, and all the luggage literally opened, and everything was in the middle of the aisle. So there was kids screaming, moms screaming. Moms were passing down their kids on the over the chairs to take them out in case the parents didn't want. They just wanted their kids out. It was terrifying. No, I don't even know if there's a word for it, but terrifying is the only thing I can think of.
There are not many people on Earth who have had miracles like this. When you think about fate and all the things this incredible story of survival points to, what occurs to you?
You know, our faith is strong. We felt definitely there's something above us that was taking care of us. God definitely was the one who was guiding us that day. We are so grateful to Him and so grateful that we are all here. We were given another life that day. We have to now, in turn, give back to the same causes and people that He would want us to be appreciative to. You know, I think for me, my faith was there, but it is solidified at 1,000%. There was no way this was not a miracle. There was no way.
Does anything come immediately to mind on how you want to give back?
Honestly, I feel like my whole career has been based on working with people with disabilities and rare diseases, but I really want to bring that to a larger scale. We have a small nonprofit, but make it bigger, make it stronger, bring more people together, find more resources for families who have rare diseases like our own. I feel like I was always kind of, well, I'll do it. Maybe I won't. Maybe I will. But now I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. There's no way. We've been given another life, and we have to use that life for the good and the benefit of others.
Dorelia Rivera, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Bye.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. Most Americans don't have a will. 20 years ago, that wasn't a shocking statement. You had to find a trustworthy attorney and pay them by the hour to draft your will. But these days, there's no excuse. LegalZoom has made it easy to create your own will, and they're not a law firm, so you don't pay hourly rates. August is National Make-A-Will Month at LegalZoom.com, so now it's your turn to take control of your family and assets with an estate plan. It starts with a will or living trust, and if you don't know which one is right for you, no problem. LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys can advise you on what's best for you and your family. That's why more than 1 million people have used LegalZoom for their estate planning needs. Just go to LegalZoom.com/world to check out LegalZoom's Last Will and Living Trust Estate Plans and get special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/world to take care of your family and save money doing it. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. Google is reportedly making a special version of its search engine. It's for use in China to comply with their strict online censorship rules.
With all its power, with all its reputation, probably the most famous internet company in the whole world, complying with the censorship in China, that sends such a big message.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A solemn ceremony took place in Hawaii yesterday, marking the arrival of 55 caskets of human remains from North Korea. Vice President Mike Pence was on hand. He credited North Korean leader Kim Jong-un with fulfilling a promise.
Some have called the Korean War the forgotten war. But today, we prove these heroes were never forgotten. Today, our boys are coming home.
So whose remains are in the caskets and what happens to them next? Dave Phillips has been looking into those questions for the New York Times. Dave, let's start with the basics. Where have the remains been kept and managed all these years?
That's really a mystery. I think that not even the forensic anthropologists at the military's lab know. What they do know is that most of the bones that have been returned over the years have been white and covered in a whitish powder that they suggest means they were stored in what they call a climate-controlled space. What that means, I think they're not even exactly sure, but they weren't buried. They might have been stored in an old mine or cave.
Will that have any effect on the forensic investigation?
To an extent, yes, because when you turn over bones without the context of where they came from, it takes away a lot of the clues that can be used to build an identity. If someone saw a sergeant get blown up in a foxhole in a certain valley, and you then find the remains close to where that foxhole was, that can help you. But if things are turned over with no background on where they were, no personal effects, you're really starting from scratch.
So tell us what is involved exactly in the identification process, and can you offer any examples of the kind of challenges that some of these remains will present to forensic investigators?
Yeah, so some of the types of tools they use to identify are very old, such as comparing dental records. Some of them are quite new. The government labs have some of the best techniques for recovering old mitochondrial DNA that they can use to then compare to family members. But then they've also developed kind of a cool and accidental technology where each of us, our clavicle, our collarbone, is as unique in shape as our fingerprints are unique. And so someone a few years ago at the lab figured out that all of these young service members, or nearly all of them, had had a chest x-ray when they did their Army physical. And those x-rays were still around. And so they essentially built an algorithm where they can very quickly, using computer, compare all known x-rays to, you know, the clavicle they found. And oftentimes they make an ID that way.
So there was this preliminary examination in South Korea, and the remains appear to be human and non-Asian, but are they American?
We don't know. So I think this is often forgotten about the Korean War, but it was a UN effort with more than a dozen different countries contributing troops. You know, there may be French there may be Australians there.
As far as DNA testing, I mean, that requires samples from close relatives, but with the Korean War ending 65 years ago, I mean, does the military keep an active database of survivors?
You know, it's in the past few years, as the military really realized the power of DNA, they went into this huge effort to gather what they call family reference samples. A sample from, it doesn't have to be immediate kin, it could be a cousin, it could be an uncle. Actually, they prefer to have, they need to have female kin for the mitochondrial DNA. But they have now gathered more than 7,000 references for 92% of all the missing service members in Korea, which is really a pretty amazing feat.
So one dog tag was amongst the remains with a legible name. What exactly happens to the remains that are identified? Where do they go?
So we don't know whose dog tag that is, and we actually don't even know if the dog tag has anything to do with any of these remains.
Huh.
You know, time after time, the scientists who do this work have figured out that the dog tag has nothing to do with the remains that it was found near. Now, what happens to these remains? They will be tested. They will try to identify them. If they can make an identification, they notify the military's casualty assistance teams, and they contact the families. All of these missing military service members have a family member of record out there. Their wife might have died. Their children at this point are even getting quite old, but there's usually someone in the next of kin that will be notified and the remains will be returned.
You've spoken with family members of those missing from the Korean War. What do they say they're feeling right about now?
Well, this is something that most of us probably don't think about too much. You know, the missing dead from a war nearly 70 years ago. But for these families, a lot of them think of it constantly. They've been hoping and waiting for news, often for their whole lives. So any sign that there's a warming of relations, a chance to get in there and find more answers for them is very good news.
So in the past, there's been trouble with the North Koreans returning remains without any of the kind of telling evidence originally with the remains or without any information on the origin of the remains. And obviously, those clues can help a lot in identification. What do we know about what came with the current set of remains of these 55?
So we got 55 crates back from North Korea, and they arrived in Hawaii this week. But we have no idea whether those 55 crates are 55 service members. In fact, if the past is any indication, they're probably not. In the past, the North Koreans have turned over crates of bones, and they've been almost random jumbles where there might be one box that has partial skeletons of six different people. From everything that I have heard, there's a similar situation with these bones. They are what they call commingled. They don't have many identifying materials with them, like military equipment, although there is some. Apparently, there's some boots and canteens, things like that. But it's going to be very difficult. Even sorting out which bones belong to which skeleton will take quite some time.
Yeah, and given those challenges, I mean, even with modern technology, how successful is the identification process? I mean, hundreds of remains returned from North Korea in the 90s and early 2000s. How many of them have been confirmed and identified?
Of those hundreds, only about half have ever been confirmed and identified.
And what happens to the remains that can't be identified?
Well, they wait. They've been waiting for 70 years, and we never know what technology is going to come next. So I think they are preserved so that somewhere down the line, someone can answer these questions.
Dave, finally, I just want to ask you as to President Trump's thanking Kim in such magnanimous terms on Twitter for this act. Was he praising the chairman prematurely, or is this act really worthy of a major thank you?
Well, something that the director of the lab that does these identifications said to me yesterday was, I think, very telling. After the Vietnam War, of course, there were very bad relations between the Republic of Vietnam and the United States. And one of the first diplomatic overtures was the exchange of remains. And that allowed other diplomatic channels to sort of build on that. You know, how big of a deal is it that we receive 55 crates of bones? It may be a very big deal. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Dave Phillips of the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a trial going on right now in a courtroom in Alexandria, Virginia. You know the one I'm talking about. Paul Manafort, a former campaign manager for President Trump, is facing a raft of tax evasion charges. He's alleged to have stashed $60 million in undisclosed overseas accounts. Where did the earnings come from? Ukraine. The charges against Manafort involve his lobbying activities on behalf of the former Russian-backed government in Ukraine, and that got us wondering what's changed in Ukraine since that government was toppled 3 years ago. One big change, it turns out, big gains for working women. Our Across Women's Lives correspondent Allison Herrera has been looking into just what that means in Kiev.
That sound, it's not a happy one. That's a police officer printing off a traffic ticket. In a touristy area of Kiev, 27-year-old patrol police company commander Yaroslava Trushina is issuing this ticket to a driver who was caught going the wrong way on a one-way street.
I get enjoyment from my work. My work is a bit of everything. It's always new every day. Moments of rest, interrupted by shots of adrenaline.
Issuing tickets may not be a big adrenaline rush, but that's not all she does.
Robbery, gang activity, murder, anything is possible. When I leave my home in the morning, I'm calm and quiet. I don't share my work stress with my family. I've learned to control my emotions.
Lieutenant Trushina is fairly new to the force. She's been on the job for 3 years. That's because before 2015, she wouldn't have been allowed to be a patrol officer. Then the country went through a massive change. Ukrainians took to the streets to oust Russian-backed President Viktor Yanukovych in what was called the Euromaidan, or Revolution of Dignity. And with the new government came new opportunities for women. The Ministry of Health lifted a decades-old ban on women entering up to 450 professions. Now women can drive trucks, operate farming equipment, and yes, be beat cops. And women make up 21% of the national police force. For Lieutenant Trushina, it's a dream come true. She manages a unit of 60 officers, Most of them are men.
If they're late, they have to do 50 push-ups on the ground. I can't keep repeating myself to everyone throughout the day, so I decided to institute push-ups.
Women like Lieutenant Trushina are helping to reshape the image of the police in Ukraine, which up until recently had the reputation of being a corrupt institution. There is the perception that women are more trustworthy, but as Trushina points out, it's going to take a lot more than just female officers to fight corruption and restore trust.
Коли почалася в нас реформа, то працівник міліції отримав $350. Зараз працівник поліції отримує.
When police reform began, a police officer earned around $350 a month. Now earnings have gone up to $380, but the cost of living has tripled. This is not a dignified salary. And you often hear from officers that the low pay makes them susceptible to the temptation of corruption.
When women were initially recruited and trained, the story made international news. Female officers sporting red lipstick and perfect nails posed for selfies with people on the street. Lieutenant Trushina posed for her fair share of selfies. She's tall, thin, with long hair and steely blue eyes. But she says that all she cares about is being a good cop.
During the first year, yes, they took selfies. But now people are afraid to approach me. I usually tell people, go take pictures with the male officers.
Lieutenant Trushina and women like her were trained with the help of U.S. tax dollars. After the Euromaidan revolution, the Obama administration committed $20 million to help the Ukrainian government implement reforms in law enforcement. But there are some problems money can't solve, like the perception that women are weak.
Вона маленька, худенька, ну, мініатюрна. І хлопці боялися їхати з нею в нічний час.
I had a situation when a petite woman joined the force. The boys were afraid to partner with her during night shift. When I told them that she was just like me, I asked why they're not afraid to respond to crimes with me, but are asking not to work with this girl.
Trushina, like her fellow officers, has high hopes for the new police force. For her, it's not only about battling stereotypes. It's about making law enforcement better for everyone, including her own daughter. Lieutenant Trushina is a single mom.
Буде постояти питання, перше, грабунок або дитина, то я собі поставлю дитину.
For a long time, I saw the problems in law enforcement, and now I have an opportunity to bring change. I want my child to be able to grow up going outside, playing, and not to be scared.
For The World, I'm Alison Herrera, Kiev, Ukraine.
The women on the Kiev police force may not be posing for selfies, but they did agree to let us take their portraits. You can see them now on the Across Women's Lives Instagram feed. That's at Women's Lives, all one word. Just enough time now before the break to give you a quick preview of a story we'll have for you on tomorrow's show. It's about a video that's gone viral in France of a man slapping a woman on a Paris street. That was after she reprimanded him for sexually harassing her. French journalist Rokia Diallo says the woman's experience was instructive.
As a woman, you can be harassed in the street. You have people who say, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you try to protest or to prevent the person to attack you? And she actually gave the reason why, because you don't want to be beaten up in the streets, because she was, you know, in a terrace. There were many people, including men. And nobody actually, just one man tried to move, but nobody, you know, succeeded in trying to prevent the slap that she got in the face. So it showed something that was known by most of the women, but that was very difficult to show, to display, and to prove.
By the way, street harassment is now against the law in France. You can be fined the equivalent of up to $875. That legislation passed today, just days after the video went viral. You can hear the full interview with Rokia Diallo on tomorrow's show. Google's slogan used to be, "Don't be evil." When Google consolidated itself under parent company Alphabet in 2015, that slogan changed to, "Do the right thing." That note is important background for this next story about Google and China. The company has been working on a custom version of its search engine, a version that would comply with Beijing's strict online censorship rules. That's according to documents obtained by The Intercept. Ryan Gallagher is an investigative reporter there and got the scoop. You actually got to see some of the internal documents about this project, Ryan. What would the Chinese version of Google look like?
Well, I mean, it kind of just looks like this, the same Google that you and I would view on our smartphones. But the thing that's obviously going to be different about it is that it's censoring certain words and phrases that have been deemed undesirable by the ruling Communist Party regime. So the content itself would be restricted.
Yes, so like if you tried to search Tiananmen Square, you would not be able to find anything, presumably. And the list is huge, right?
Yeah, I mean, the list of things that are routinely censored on the Chinese internet is quite extraordinary. For example, George Orwell book 1984 and Animal Farm as well, references to them were being censored. Anything that kind of could be deemed to have reflect badly on an authoritarian government, you know, anything to do even with the families of some of the top Communist Party officials, that gets censored. Mm. You know, really, things about religion also routinely censored, academic studies, things about, for example, Western legal structures and like rule of law and that type of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the level of political sensitivity in China. What phase is this project in? Is it something that's simply being discussed internally at Google, or is there an actual rollout date?
My understanding is it sort of began in the early last year and really took off after December when Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, had a high-level private meeting with one of the top Communist Party officials in China. And what is they've been planning is to have the app ready to launch really at any moment. But in the last few years, Google has been launching different apps. Like it launched a Chinese specific translate app. It also launched last year a artificial intelligence research center in Beijing. Also, they pumped in $500 million into a Chinese online company recently, JD.com. So slowly, it's kind of incrementally upping its presence in China. And this is a very deliberate strategy by the top leadership at Google. They're trying to basically curry favor with the Chinese regime so that Google becomes familiar to them, Google becomes friendly to them.
And then kind of becomes indispensable.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And this is a very deliberate strategy on the part of Google to do that and to then get themselves leveraged into a position where they get the approval to launch the search engine.
What incentive does Beijing have to do that, especially when China's been trying to wean itself off foreign technology?
Another really good question. I don't know what incentive the Chinese government has. Probably a lot of the decision making is based on what can we get out of this. You know, it could be even just things as simple as, well, it would give us access to certain data, or there is something slightly appealing in terms of almost from a kind of propaganda perspective for the Chinese regime to have these massive companies, you know, setting up massive, big, glamorous kind of offices in Beijing and these places, and also like recruiting Chinese people in large numbers.
So Google has previously operated its flagship product, that would be its search engine, in China between 2006 and 2010, but it pulled out because of security vulnerabilities and those censorship restrictions. And some China watchers would say those same issues are still there, perhaps even worse now. So why go back in the first place?
Money is probably a big factor. There are some like 750 million Chinese internet users. That's more than the entire continent of Europe population-wise. So it's an incredible opportunity economically. And one of the key factors, I believe, is that actually there's been quite a major shift in leadership at Google. It's a new CEO, Sundar Pichai. He wants to be back in China. He thinks it's better to have a restricted version of Google than no Google at all.
How does he justify that?
Well, you know, I would love to put that question to him. I really would. And I've asked Google, how can you say in 2010 that it's appalling and that you're not going to be involved in this, you know, complicity with the totalitarian regime, but then 8 years later do a complete reversal on that? How can you actually explain that? And I've not had a single reply. I mean, they've actually not even sent me one reply. That tells you about Google's attitude internally towards it. And I think actually it speaks to a real problem, I think, in the internal culture at Google at a management level, if they think that what they're doing is acceptable.
So Google, born in the USA in this culture of free expression and open access to information, but in order to gain access to a market of nearly 1.5 billion people, they're willing to offer this downward sliding scale of openness and transparency because Google Alphabet shareholders. Is that a fair conclusion?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for Google, but I do think that, I mean, yeah, there's no other conclusion you can come to with this, that they're choosing to make an absolutely massive compromise that totally contradicts some of the fundamental values that they have claimed to hold as a company. They've claimed to value free information, you know, an open internet. Their old motto was don't do evil. It's hard to reconcile all of that with going into China and becoming complicit in the most extreme draconian censorship regime that exists in the world. You know, that's the bottom line of this. And, you know, it's hard to see what good comes out of this for Google. I think that the backlash I've seen in the last day has been absolutely extraordinary. People from all around the world have been expressing all kinds of concerns about this.
Do you think we'll see more American companies willing to make this trade-off if it does come to pass?
Well, yeah, I think this is the danger. If it does go ahead, it sets a kind of precedent for the government itself, and the Chinese regime then has an expectation that other companies will follow with the censorship, because there are still some companies in China that try to resist and things like that, and it basically weakens their case. But the other aspect of it is that other authoritarians will be looking at that and thinking, well, why can't we get that? That's what we want. If you don't allow us to do that, we're going to not allow you to operate in our country. And then there becomes this expectation that the censorship is something that becomes, it basically normalizes. And that is the big concern about this.
Ryan Gallagher, an investigative reporter and editor with The Intercept. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.